A rash of violence in Kansas City this summer has fueled ongoing debates about how to curb our city's homicide problem. Mayor Sly James says it comes down to political choices, specifically about guns.
We need to vote for people who understand what we're talking about and agree with it and will promote it. Without change in the legislature, we're not going to have any change in this situation.
But he suggests that he himself feels a bit powerless on the issue.
Do you really think this is the first time I've had this tirade? I do this once a week.
Congressman Emmanuel Cleaver, who's also a former Kansas City mayor and a reverend, sees it another way.
We've got to quit thinking that mayors and councils and presidents and senators can stop homicides. You'd have to have a police on every corner and every house. It's something that we've got to breed out of us. And when I say breed, I mean it's parents getting their kids, raising them in a way that, in which those kids grow up respecting human life.
Okay, so a lot to unpack there, and we will do that later in the show, but I want to start this conversation about violence in Kansas City with the police department just to get a better handle on the details of what's happening. Then we'll get the community's eye view, including your perspectives after that. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and Jake Bikina is with us now from the Kansas City Police Department. He's the Public Information Officer. Thanks for being here, Jake.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
When would you say this spike in shootings really began?
Probably a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, we saw a real rise in numbers over about a 10-day stretch.
What are the numbers? Like, what are we actually dealing with here?
We had a stretch of time where in a 10-day stretch, we had a series of 8 homicides that we investigated. And during a similar stretch along that timeline, we had a series from a Wednesday to Sunday of 24 total shooting victims.
That is just really like a harrowing number. How does that compare with what you would probably unfortunately call normal?
That is more than what we would what we statistically see in a normal week. However, it is still the totals for 2018 in both shootings, non-fatal shootings, and homicides are down from 2017 still.
So from what I've read about this, the incidents appear to be unrelated to one another. Is that still what the police department's thinking about this?
That is, yes. There appears to be no relation from one scene to the next, no like group that's responsible for several different series of shootings. It seems to all be individual situations that have erupted into this violence.
How do you know that?
A lot of it comes from, you know, detectives will interview witnesses, victims at the scene, gather as much information as they can, talk to family members, and just kind of get a piece or piece together, get a real idea of what occurred in each one of the situations.
I imagine that having this level of activity to respond to, though, changes things around the police department, puts a crunch on people's ability to do what you just described really thoroughly. How do you adjust to the demands on your resources when something like this happens?
It is. And last Friday, Chief Smith, you know, we held a press conference and Chief Smith spoke and he talked specifically to that point that, you know, resources are stretched. However, we have processes in place that we've designed to stretch those resources. We have dozens of trained investigators. We have crime scene personnel on all the shifts and to cover days off. So we've never run out of people, although people have been stretched. And this
is
what...
When you say stretched, I mean, I don't mean to interrupt, but I'm like, what does that look like? I'm curious. I mean, I think that when people are all putting in overtime, they're also exhausted, and this is emotionally draining work.
Sure, yeah. You know, stretched does look like overtime. You know, a normal 8-hour day will get stretched into a 10-hour day or maybe even a 12-hour day. There's always groups of investigators and crime scene personnel that are on call and ready to respond 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it's just a matter of proper rest and renewal. You know, when you do have some downtime, you know, that those on-call cycles, they rotate through different groups. So it's not just like the same group always responding. So there's groups that rotate through.
So you've said that you never have just run out of people, but has there been fallout? Are there things that you have to sort of shelve and put on a back burner?
Not necessarily. You know, each case is gets its priority. Each case is worked to the fullest extent that it possibly can be from a crime scene investigation standpoint, also from a detective investigation standpoint. Each one of these cases is very important to us. We take each one seriously, and there are none that get, like, put on a back burner or a back shelf, so to speak. They are all investigated to the fullest extent that they possibly can be.
There are theories floating around, and we're going to hear more about this later, that the summer heat has a lot to do with what's going on right now, and that just people are out and about mingling more, teenagers are out of school, more opportunities for conflict. But do we always see this intense of a summer violence peak, or is something different going on?
I do think the summer months tend to be a little busier. I don't have exact numbers. I look forward to hearing what our friends in criminology have to say about that, because their business is studying the numbers. I do think, you know, just from a feeling standpoint, it does seem to feel a little busier in the summertime.
In general?
Yes, in general.
Well, one thing that I've been heartened to hear, if that's even an appropriate thing to say in this context, is that people have been calling the police. I mean, the incidents of, for example, prolonged gunfire elicited numerous calls to the police, as I understand it. Isn't that typically a problem, getting people to involve you guys?
We could always use more involvement from the public, from a witness standpoint, from a participation standpoint as a victim of crime. We could always use more. Our TIPS hotline is, you know, their sole mission is gathering information anonymously. They've increased their reward from $5,000 to $10,000 most recently, and we've paid out two of those rewards, two $10,000 rewards, for information leading to arrest in a crime. And, you know, we can always use more information. And part of that is our responsibility to cultivate those relationships ahead of time in our communities so that people feel comfortable with us and they're not just seeing us when something's gone wrong, that they feel comfortable with us and have a sense of trust with their police department so that they feel like the thing that they should do is what they also feel safe to do.
I mean, what are the challenges on that?
As far as building relationships, I mean, that challenge continues all the time. Our responsibility is to serve a community and make it the best community it possibly can be citywide. And we have people in place that are charged with that, not necessarily violent crimes investigative people, but we have community interaction officers that are assigned to every patrol division station on two shifts during the daytime and into the evening. Their job is to build relationships and foster that that relationship with the community and the police department ahead of time. We are always running into people out in the community that only see the police when something's gone wrong. And that is a huge challenge for us. And it's one that we're undertaking. Chief Smith thought that very important. He brought the Community Interaction Officer program back. Not only did he bring it back, but he doubled it in size. And so he takes that very seriously, and our department takes it very seriously. It's not something that can happen overnight. It takes place. Every single interaction is an opportunity to build relationship. And so each one of those interactions along the way is just a little building block in that.
If we always see what feels to you like a little spike in activity in the summer, why does it keep happening? I mean, is there something that can be, I mean, you're talking about prevention. Is there something that can be done anticipating that every summer, or are there already efforts like that?
There are. We have proactive investigative squads that take criminal intelligence information, patterns, trends, information they gather from sources, and they go out and they work that information. The thing about it is you can never, it's hard to prove a negative. You can never say what was going to happen but didn't as a result of a proactive investigation.
Yeah.
And so rest assured, I mean, I would want like the community to be assured that we have proactive efforts underway, some of them overt with, you know, increased patrols in certain areas based on calls for service volume and intelligence information, some of them covert based on long-term, you know, undercover investigations as well.
Tell me more about the overt ones. I would ask about the covert ones, but I am suspecting you wouldn't say much.
Yeah, those are obviously part of ongoing investigations. From an overt perspective, each division commander meets with the chief on a weekly basis, and they go over crime factors in their divisions. And they strategize with other division commanders.
Crime factors, does that mean things that you would suspect could contribute to crime?
Sure, yeah. Some of them being obvious, increase in, a violent crime in a particular area, you would, maybe put more patrol officers, directly in that area around the time of, if you have a pattern. There are crime analysts that are assigned to each division as well to analyze those patterns. And based on that intelligence information, it's up to the division commander to direct their resources that they have, their proactive resources, at those patterns to try to interrupt those violent cycles.
Well, before I let you go, I want to bring Damon Daniel of the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime in on this. He's an activist and advocate who's been trying to change this whole dynamic on behalf of especially African-American communities in the urban core in a lot of different capacities. And Damon, anything you want to respond to or add in what you've already heard?
I don't think so. I think Jake covered it pretty well, as it relates to some of what we are seeing, from our perspective in terms of the victim services, organization, as well.
Do you agree with his assessment that the community police relations are improving and that the police department is making, is that robust effort something that you are seeing appreciated on the other end of that relationship?
I think we all, the best way to answer that is yes, in some ways, but there's a lot of room for improvement. The relationship between the community and law enforcement didn't get to where it is overnight. It was, we're talking about decades of abuse of power and things of that nature, particularly as it relates to African-American community and minority communities, and we still see that today. And so I think there is an appreciation, especially for neighborhoods that are well organized, that are reaching out to law enforcement and asking for more of their presence there. But then I think that there's still a pocket or two or three of within our community that is still experiencing racial profiling, that's still experiencing what they would refer to as blatant disrespect as well. And so the police department still has a long way to go. And so does the community. I mean, it is a relationship, and relationships have reciprocity within them. And so on one hand, the community does have to step up, especially when we talk about violence in our community and helping the police department solve these crimes. And so those same communities that are calling 911 and requesting for an increase in police presence are the same communities that are also complaining about law enforcement, too.
When Jake Bikina just said that part of the problem is that there can be this situation where people see police officers only when something terrible has happened, there was a lot of vigorous nodding in this room when he said that. And I'm curious if you can talk a little bit more about that dynamic.
Well, one thing I've seen the police department do here recently, particularly Kansas City, Missouri Police Department, is do the OK program, which is a mentoring program. And I've seen them do that very well within the Hickory Mill School District, particularly. And so I think that
officers mentoring young people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that we need more of that as well. Then you also have the Police Athletic League and things like that, too. The more youth are getting involved in. I wish that it was beyond just like the Northeast area, but it was. I think that there needs to be a PAL program in all of the precincts areas as well. I think that that would definitely improve the relationship between youth and law enforcement.
I'm curious to know more about this mentoring program. It seems like I can understand the idea of it helping the young people in whatever way, just having someone kind of taking them under their wing. But what about the officers? What do they gain from that program?
Well, I think, and I'm sure Jake can probably speak to it more, but, when you wear that uniform, and as Jake already said, most folks, have that negative experience. I think if you're wearing the uniform and that is the perception of you, especially if you're African-American wearing that uniform, and then you'd be able to be seen in a different light and have a different relationship with youth than be seen in a positive, it does good. And I think it feels good for those who wear the uniform to put the uniform on and feel proud.
As we get ready to broaden this conversation, just to talk about the bigger issues about violence in our communities, do you have questions right now inspired by what's been going on lately, this new what feels to a lot of people anyway like a new flare-up, but maybe to you doesn't. I don't know. What questions do you have?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, there's a lot of things that I could ask, and you catch me off guard with that one as well. But, you know, I think my questions are really to the community as it relates to what else is working that you see in the community, what isn't working that you wish you could tweak a bit. Those are the questions I would have for the community at large. You know, oftentimes you hear me and you hear others within law enforcement say that we just wish people would learn to resolve a conflict without violence, and saying that conflict mediation is the way to go. My question to the community is, do you believe that? Is it enough of that being taught within our schools? How is it reinforced within our homes as well? I've been talking a lot about forgiveness and talking about the principles that go along with that, and how you can, once you forgive somebody, how it makes you feel both mentally and physically as well. Is there something to that, Kansas City?
Well, call 816-235-2888 if you want to chime in on this. Jake Bikina, what are you hearing? What do you want to say in response to what Damon just told us?
Well, I would like to touch on one thing in particular. Our youth academy, I said urban, it started in the East Patrol Division, but it has spread. We've done 3 out of 4 scheduled sessions for a youth academy for the summer. Obviously, school is right about to be back in session. Exactly what Damon had said, this idea of this police and youth interaction, they basically get a crash course in our department over the course of 1 week. They get, they see our crime scene unit. They see our training academy. They see some of our specialized units, our canine section, our helicopter section. And they get this overall perspective. And so many of them have come out of that week-long experience and they said, you know, I see the police as people now. I see there's individual people wearing those uniforms. I have a different perspective for the job that they do now. And I think programs like that, in addition to mentoring programs, are really the key with our youth, because, you know, our youth are deciding in their ages, you know, from 8 to 10 to 12, as they're coming into their teenage years, they're deciding about how they feel about their police. They're developing their feelings, their opinions based on their experiences. And again, that falls on us to help them, you know, to help interact with them in those positive ways.
Officer Jake Bikina with us from the Kansas City Police Department. Thanks so much. In just a moment, we'll turn the focus to what people are doing and saying about the recent shootings in communities that deal with them most intimately. Call 816-235-2888 to share your thoughts or ask your questions. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we've been talking about a rash of violent crime in Kansas City this morning and the ongoing issue of gun violence that's a part of. Call 816-235-2888 to talk about how it's affecting you or what you and people you know are doing, either formally or informally, to try and make some kind of difference. 816-235-2888. I do want to acknowledge that we've been talking about urban violence, and I want to talk to Toya Like, who's with us from UMKC, about that. She's a professor of criminal justice and criminology. Toya, what biases might we need to address from the outset before we dig any deeper here? Because when we say gun violence, there are a lot of preconceived ideas of who's affected by it, who's perpetrating the violence, that might shape the way we talk, whether we realize it or not.
Well, gun violence is pervasive in the United States, and in fact, it's what separates us from other industrialized countries that we're often compared to, is our rate of homicide, and that is facilitated by and large by handguns and the accessibility of handguns in the United States. So that really shapes sort of the issue of violence and homicide in particular for our nation. So guns absolutely are instrumental in terms of our high homicide rate, and it explains why we are set apart from much of the industrialized world in that way.
Talk to me about the recent shootings. They say the incidents are unconnected, just all happening at once. What's your take on that? Why now?
Well, violence is interpersonal by and large. Most people are assaulted or victimized by someone that they know. And so these are usually conflicts that arise between people where there's no resolution outside of the use of violence to sort of deal with that. And then when you compound that with the lack of faith and trust in the criminal justice system to resolve disputes or to handle them, that explains how these encounters typically happen.
When you say that there's no recourse other than violence, can you explain that a little more?
I think it's something that Damon and Jake touched on earlier, is sort of the lack of faith and trust in the police and the disconnect, the historical as well as the contemporary disconnect between the African-American community and the law enforcement community, right? That we cannot ignore the historical context of that, right? The differential policing, prosecution, and punishment of African-Americans in the United States has allowed for this sort of gap in distance between those two communities who are not trusting of one another. And especially when you are looking at, especially if we look like at policing in particular, where police officers that are servicing communities that are experiencing high crime rates typically don't live in those communities, right? So you have all of these gaps that divide these groups that could come together to resolve these disputes before they end in violence. And so all of those gaps really facilitate the lack of resolution in that way.
So you're saying that the lack of trust, though, goes both ways.
Absolutely.
Can you explain the lack of trust, what that looks like from those two different perspectives?
From the perspective of African-Americans, and again, something that both touched on earlier, the need for seeing police outside of just policing, right? And outside of Big Brother, Big Sister watching. And so the importance of that, and research has shown that for African-American young men prior to the age of, I'd say 10 or 11, have had like positive experiences with the police. It's once they become adolescents and then become targeted by the police as suspect, right? And so this perception, this ubiquitous view of Black people as threatening, as dangerous, and Black males in particular as threatening and dangerous really facilitates that. And then on the side of police, right, this idea, if for instance, just everyday people, if we're shown mugshots all the time that show a young Black male, right, then our perception of who's dangerous, who's threatening, and our susceptibility to that threat and danger is heightened. And I don't assume that police officers are any different from the general population in that way, right? If we're shown images all the time of who's criminal, who's dangerous, who's violent, then we begin to associate people with those characteristics, with those behaviors.
I've noticed, lately I have a really little kid and I'm sort of trying to be careful about what he is exposed to and what kind of ideas that might create. And it is amazing how much more sensitive I am even to noticing, like, even in magazines that have nothing to do with violence or anything, like the back cover will be some ad and you know who's going to be holding a gun.
Absolutely.
It's
absolutely
horrible.
Absolutely. Media depictions, pop culture, it all sort of demonstrates this view. And it's and so much of it is rooted and grounded in stereotypes about people. And given the level in which we are segregated from one another, right, that we still have communities that are largely predominantly Black or predominantly white. So much of what we know about each other and cultural differences are going to be sort of portrayed to us by media outlets. And if that outlet is rooted and grounded in stereotypical notions about others, right, then that shapes sort of, again, that disconnect between and divide between those groups.
Damon Daniel, I'm going to bring you back in just a minute. We spoke earlier, but this feels to me like the right time to turn to Andrea Tudhope. She's the general assignment reporter here at KCUR, and she did a project on gun violence called The Argument. I want to turn to her because, Andrea, it does seem to me that part of what's going on here is about media representation. Do you think that media attention on violence can help if it's done, sensitively, or does it have pitfalls kind of like what we've been hearing?
Yeah, I think you're right. This is a good time for me to chime in. I think that we have to acknowledge the role that our own coverage plays in this, right? So it's true that violence is concentrated in certain areas in this city, and there, year after year, the majority of both suspects and victims are actually Black men. But I think, as you know, if we find ourselves only reporting on certain neighborhoods when there's a killing or when something bad happens, and it so happens that neighborhood has a lot of killings, and then we're only talking about that neighborhood again and again for that reason, we're painting complex communities with a broad brush, right? So we're contributing to this like simplified negative image of that place and those people as bad. And I think the way that plays out is kind of hard to measure, you know? So I think we as journalists have a responsibility to be more proactive rather than just reactive, and talk more with people like Damon from Ad Hoc. And I don't want to speak for you, but you know, they do a lot of prevention work. And if we start telling more stories about, if we spend more time telling stories about healthy relationship classes and conflict resolution, and spend more time in these communities telling good stories too, then I think that will help.
Damon, jump in here.
I couldn't agree more. I was sitting here saying to myself, she's spot on. You know, I was just sitting thinking, though, we have some family that's in town staying with us for a little while, and they have a 7-year-old daughter. And we were watching television the other day, and a couple were kissing, and she quickly turned her head and was like, ew. But then the next scene was a violent scene, and they were shooting, and she was totally okay with that. And we all paused and we were like, why is it that her reaction was so, so different than watching the violence versus watching two people kiss? And it's because our society has normalized violence, from video games to television, and you name it, it's everywhere. And so our children are picking this up, and it's just becoming a part of the norm. And so Andrea is absolutely right with that.
I mean, when Andrea talks about the way that we tell these stories, I think about just the way that we talk about fear. We talk a lot about the fear of potential victims, or of relatives of victims, the people closest to the victims. Would you say that fear is also something we should be talking about with perpetrators?
Yeah, I think so. And reason why is because, you know, there's nothing really out there that protects witnesses. And so when you, whether you've lost a loved one to violence, or you've been a victim of a violent assault or anything like that, and you know who did it, you know, whether it's in the discovery, once they've arrested that person and they've released your information to that person, there's nothing that really protects you as the witness out there. And so it makes it all the more difficult for law enforcement sometimes to help protect people, you know, and some of those folks that are out there. And I can say this because we've, you know, we serve, you know, everyone who's a victim of a homicide or a violent crime, regardless of you the perpetrator or, you know, just an innocent bystander even. And recently I had a couple that came to us for assistance. And this was the second time within about a year they've come to us. And the first time they came to us, their home was shot up and riddled with bullets. And you know, we tried to work with them to look at what was it that caused this, who's after them, those sorts of things. And they just really weren't forthcoming with good information for us in terms of whether or not we really trusted, you know, what they were saying was true. And then here it is almost a year later, and their house gets shot up again. And of course, they've moved, and this violence has followed them. And so it kind of gives us a different perspective in terms of understanding even what police departments go through, because even sometimes the victims are not all that honest, whether, you know, the house is broken into and someone stole some pound of drugs and money, where they're not going to say all of that to the law enforcement, even though law enforcement is not there for that. You know, they're there because they've called 911, their house is broken into. So they're not going to necessarily look at investigating that unless there's, of course, more of that around. But people just don't trust that. And they don't really know the law either.
So, Andrea, I mean, when we talk about stories like the one Damon is telling us, how do we avoid sensationalism? It is possible that people watch news segments on TV and don't deeply feel the difference between that and the latest police drama on Netflix or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, there's a definite fetishization of crime in this country. I mean, every show that we love, every podcast that we love, video games, it's everywhere. But I want to get back to the point about asking about perpetrators, because I think that that's a really big part of this. Like, these are victims and perpetrators. These are people. These are the incidents of violence. These are stories of human conflict. You know, they're really actually relatable. And I think, you know, we don't often have time to dive in deep to every story to figure out why a person had a gun in the first place, to figure out why they felt like they couldn't call the police for help, why they never had a healthy relationship. We don't always get time to do that when violence is happening so frequently. And typically, we only learn about the perpetrator if it's a high-profile case or if there's something unusual about it. We always hear about the victim, but less often we hear about the perpetrator. The problem with that is that these people have backstories. You know, there's a history of abuse, trauma exposure. I mean, there's just so much there. And I think that if we spend a little more time, you know, doing that, I think that that gets a little bit away from the sensationalism of this like perfect idea of a bad guy, you know, or like a perfect perpetrator.
I think part of the conflict there can be the fear of romanticizing someone by giving them a spotlight in the media.
Yeah, right. I mean, I don't know. I think just focusing on the fact that these are people is surprise. I mean, it sounds so simple, but I think that we sometimes miss that, you know.
Toya, jump in here.
So, but we do. We romanticize criminals all the time when they're white, right? I mean, if you look at media reports, when the perpetrator is covered and background on that perpetrator is covered, that's typically a white offender. We do not do the same when it's a person of color. And as Andrea said, there's usually a backstory. That one thing we know for sure is that the people that are most likely to experience victimization, violence, are perpetrators of crime. And so, as Damon said, you know, they are experiencing a victimization, but it may be in the context of their own criminal behavior.
Can you explain that?
In terms of that they are more likely to be exposed to other offenders because of their involvement in crime. And so they're more susceptible to victimization, more so than anyone else. So this idea of, you know, people that are not involved in crime, just experiencing violence randomly, that's more myth than reality, that the people who are more likely to experience violence are people who are involved or connected with others who are involved in violent behavior. And so we miss this whole other piece, that these are individuals who have been exposed to trauma probably early in life, have normalized and made functional dysfunctional behaviors. And so it's this really vicious cycle of, again, of conflict resolution that is dealt with extra legally as opposed to utilizing the justice system.
Andrea, as someone who has kind of initiated conversations with people, tried to earn trust and learn the human side of a story, can you talk to us a little bit about how you begin to do that and what you learn in the process?
Well, and I can speak to what I did last year in my coverage, in our series, The Argument. I mean, I spent a couple of months meeting with Damon and Brandon Mims at Ad Hoc, kind of poring over cases. And because the project was to focus on six cases, right, to give us an opportunity to really dive in and get into these backstories. And I wanted to partner with them because we wanted to make sure to have racial diversity, socioeconomic diversity, geographic diversity, tell stories from all across the metro and sort of break the narratives and not really like play into a more simplified understanding of what happens. So I started there, and then from there, I think that really helped to build trust with the sources. But I think that we can learn a lot from the co-victims. So these are people who are the ones left behind, whose loved ones were taken from them violently, whose loved ones have been charged with the killing of someone, who are imprisoned. These people are so brave, and they actually have so many great ideas and insights into what's really going on and what can be done with regards to violence.
I want to turn to Damon Daniel on this. Damon, has that been your experience as well, that co-victims are important resources in helping address what's going on and also maybe coming up with ideas?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, when I think about, you know, the mothers groups that we've had at Ad Hoc, even Mothers in Charge that started at Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, you know, the Mothers and Families for Healing and Justice groups that we have, a lot of, even though sometimes they come to the realization that, man, I wish I would have done this sooner or been involved with violence prevention sooner. But now that it has knocked on my door, I am here to serve. And so I think, yes, the co-victims do have a great perspective and understanding not only what it's like to lose a loved one or to be exposed to violence, but also they can also really identify what the key solutions are or would have been for them in their own situations as well.
So when we think about what's been going on lately with sort of an uptick in incidents, is that changing what people are doing in their day-to-day, just changing routines out of fear right now? Or is this the same fear people are living with all the time?
I think it's the same fear that people are living with all the time. You know, I think people are thinking twice about purchasing weapons. You know, I think that they're, I don't know what the data is either, but I would assume that a lot more people are arming themselves. And especially with the new change in laws, it's made it a lot easier to do just that. But I want to kind of take a step back and encourage the community to really think about this in terms of everything that we're talking about and what Toya mentioned, when you have someone who is rather, you know, you consider them at risk or not. There's a young man who really comes to mind that I met last year, whose mother called me because detectives had knocked on her door for a warrant, with a warrant for her son's arrest. And she reached out to us to help. She knew where her son was, but didn't want to just turn him over to the police department out of fear. And so we showed up, we met with him. Make a long story short, he had been involved in an armed robbery. When we arrived at the house, we met the mother there, but she had just got off the bus and carrying her groceries into the house. So we helped her, you know, with the groceries into the house and everything. When she opened up the refrigerator, it was empty. And so we're sitting at the kitchen table and we're asking the young man, "Why did you do this?" He said, "Man, I was hungry." He said, he was unemployed. He had a baby on the way, and he's 20 years old. When I really got to asking him about, you know, his education and things of that nature and the guys he was running with, all of that, it was really this story about a young man who felt though his choices were limited, and did what he could do to put food on the table and something in his stomach at that time. And so when we think about situations like this, I mean, that young man like that is why we started a jobs program at Ad Hoc. And
what is that program?
So it's a pre-apprenticeship program for those who are interested in the flooring industry. And so it's really about showing these young brothers and sisters a trade. And we've worked with an employer that, regardless of your criminal history or even educational attainment, as long as you have the ability to learn and to do the physical labor that requires this required for the job, we'll do the rest. And so
how do you make sure that a young man like this guy that you met is connected with this program instead of something else?
Well, we start with those we've served, and so we reach out to those individuals, as well as canvas neighborhoods and go into communities. We work with a lot of different community partners that serve the same population as we do, whether it's returning citizens or folks with substance abuse issues, and or even those who are just interested in learning a trade, regardless of their educational attainment. We've had college students that have joined the class as well and have done well in it as well, and so, you know, we're looking to expand that, and we have, and we're bringing other employers to the table as regarding that, too. So that's something that we as a community need to look at, is how we leverage mentoring, how we leverage economic opportunities to these communities.
Well, we have to take one more break this morning. We are going to continue this conversation about violence in Kansas City in just a minute. You can call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. Just a little time left. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we've been talking this morning about violence in Kansas City's neighborhoods, how it affects the people in close contact with it, and what needs to happen for the whole city to get involved in solutions. My guests are Damon Daniel with the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, Toy Alike. She's a criminal justice professor, and KCUR's Andrea Tudhope. Hi again, everyone.
Hey, Gina.
So that last thing I just said, what needs to happen for the whole city to get involved in solutions, that's something I'm really curious about because, Damon, as you were just talking about the things that actually cause a person to pick up a gun, among them, hunger. And that is a problem so much bigger than just an individual issue. I mean, that is a citywide issue. But when violence disproportionately affects different communities, how do you make everyone in a position to help motivated to help? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think I look at it like this. Our community is just like your body. And if one part of your body is ill or has a cancer, so to speak, it will eventually spread. And so if we look at our community that way, we can already see that violence has spread much like a disease, because it is a disease. It's a learned behavior, and none of us are immune to it. So whether you want to look at it through a public health lens or look at it even through an economic lens, every homicide that happens, one homicide costs about $800,000 when you consider the response to the police department, EMS, the hospitals, and all the other resources and agencies that respond to it, the criminal justice system that's involved. And so even if we wanted to look at how do we prevent it and save money, you know, so that we can divert those costs other places, they'll divert those funds to other places. You know, the other thing is, you know, you can look at it through a religious lens or a spiritual lens and just say, you know, love thy neighbor as thyself. And so if we do not see our, you know, just because I may live east of Troost doesn't mean that I am not your neighbor. We are one city.
You know, you reminded me of what Emmanuel Cleaver was saying about respect for human life. Can you talk about that? I mean, how did that comment strike you, that we need to be raising our children to respect human life?
I couldn't agree more. I think that at the end of the day, when someone feels as though their only choice is to pick up a gun and pull the trigger, they are not valuing life. They're not valuing the life that they're about to take, nor are they valuing their own life either. And they're not thinking about the risk in terms of what those actions are going to cause their family and those who love and care about them as well. I always say that there's a loss on both sides of the coin when a homicide occurs. There's a loss, of course, to the victim, but there's also a loss on the perpetrator's family as well, because they're going to lose that person to the criminal justice system as well. And so that's, we all need to be concerned about that.
Toya, like, jump in here. I mean, what is your understanding about this issue of just this issue of the loss of the perpetrator's life, first of all, and second of all, this idea of making the whole community involved in solutions, care enough to be part of solutions?
Absolutely. I mean, we know that, for instance, perpetrators typically have been involved in violence for quite a while. And so we're talking about a very cyclical sort of experience that they have with violence as perpetrators, as well as victims of violence. And the economic costs are great, even in terms of incarceration. I mean, those are great costs that affect communities and how that declines social capital further within that community. Because not only was this person involved in violence, they're typically someone's father, someone's son, and they contributed to their family socially, maybe even economically. So we're talking about huge crippling of the social capital in an already disadvantaged area. In terms of the response of the broad community, the community as a whole, we've got to invest. We know that crime is concentrated in the poorest parts of the city. That has been historically the case. That is contemporarily the case, regardless if those communities are predominantly white or predominantly black. They just happen to be predominantly black in this post-deindustrialization era. And so we've got to go back to economic investment in these communities. You know, as Damon was saying, we've got to have employment opportunities, educational opportunities, we've got to have political investment. Local governance matters. And so what we're doing about gun violence in terms of, you know, political action toward eliminating gun violence within our communities is going to matter. We've got to have social investment. We've got to talk about conflict resolution. How do schools partner with families to deal with conflicts before they be? How do we use?
What's the answer to that question?
I think schools are a great resource, right? That kids are inundated with anti-violence messages all the time in school. When you think about programs, not saying that they're highly effective, but programs like DARE happen during regular curriculum. How do we then take effective programs, things that we know work? You know, some of the programs that Damon mentioned earlier, as well as Jake, how do we use those programs to make sure that we're interrupting cycles of violence before they happen, right? That we don't know specifically how many violent encounters are reduced based on that, but we certainly, you know, because it's trying to prove a false negative, right? But it matters. I think that there's enough research that shows that when you have anti-bullying, anti-violence messaging early in the life course, that it does matter. It sort of makes us abhor violence and respect human life better. And so partnering with local churches, partnering with grassroots organizations, that all matters because that helps build, you know, this sort of unified front against violence. And, you know, as Damon said, if it happens in one community, it's going to affect it. It can happen in any community. When we stop treating it like that's a poor person or poor people's problem or black people's problems, that can happen anywhere. It can happen anywhere. And so the same things that motivate violence in those communities can spill over into other communities as well.
Damon, how much of what Toya has just described is happening and happening effectively in Kansas City?
Well, I think it is happening in terms of conflict mediation and things like that in our schools. You got Center for Conflict Resolution that is partnered with Kansas City, Missouri School District, as well as Hickman Mills School District, and they're doing what they can as well. We've partnered with Hickman Mills School District. We've also done the same with Kansas City, Missouri School District as well. Whenever there's an incident, you have groups like Aim for Peace that are out there, KC Nova. There's so many groups and organizations and resources. Though it doesn't seem as though we're reaching enough of the people, but it kind of goes back to what Jake said earlier in the question that you put on the table at the beginning, and is it you know, thinking about how connected are these homicides and the violence, and we were finding out that they're not, and they're just random acts of violence that is occurring. And that's why I go back to saying we all should be very concerned about it. It's not just something that is a poor people's problem. This is everybody's problem.
So for you, what would be, if you could just wave a magic wand and make one change that would make the work that you're trying to do toward that end easier, what would it be?
Wow.
Just one thing.
I think I would wave a magic wand and put forgiveness in everyone's heart.
What would that do?
Well, I think everyone would then be able to walk away safely.
Toya, do you think that's right based on, I mean, does research support that idea?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the role of victim offender mediations in terms of helping to deal with violence is huge. And I mean, it's amazing when you talk to homicide victim survivors, and let's say that person was condemned to death, that they find that they don't get resolution by attending the execution. It actually makes them feel worse. And so there's something to be said, victim impact statements, where the person who was offended actually has the ability to speak to that person that offended them. It really does matter.
Andrea, as you spent time with people who were close to crimes from any variety of directions in your reporting, did you find that learning more had a relationship with forgiveness for you as just a person learning about these situations?
Can you help me understand what you're asking?
I guess, you know, did you find that learning more helped you have the kind of compassion that leads to forgiveness?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I can say in a short way what I learned from the people that I spoke with, but, you know, just hearing a perpetrator's mother tell me in her own words that her son shot another man because he had this deep sense of lack, you know, I think no one else can say that better, you know, and I think that just hearing these people describe this in their own words I think we could all kind of learn a little compassion and, I don't know, gain a little bit from that.
Well, Andrea Ted Hope, reporter here at KCUR, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Toya Like with us from UMKC, Damon Daniel of the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime. Thank you both, too. Thanks for all the work you're doing.
Thank you.
And we spoke earlier with Jacob Bikina, the public information officer for the Kansas City Police Department. If you didn't catch this whole conversation about violence in Kansas City, go to kcur.org/centralstandard later today. We keep the archived shows there. And if you want, go ahead and subscribe to get them as a podcast feed so you can listen on your own time. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, the makers of a documentary about farming in America and what they've been learning. Today's show was produced by Melody Rowell with help from Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.